Scott had to risk moving her, and the sooner the better. Sliding back down on his stomach, Scott re-entered the cave. With his maglite, he checked Amanda again, only to find that her condition had not changed. Her pulse felt weak, and her breathing was still slow and shallow. Scott used his mini-shovel to move all of the snow away from the entrance of the tunnel, so he would have less trouble getting her out. After that was done, he took off his ski boots and removed his bib-style ski pants. Underneath his ski pants, he wore tight-fitting Lycra biking pants, which he prayed would be enough to keep him from suffering from exposure. As much as he hated to do it, Scott knew he had to move Amanda, to prep her and get her out. With his knife, he cut the padded straps from his backpack and fashioned a crude sea collar, which he fastened around Amanda's neck to keep it from moving. He used the supporting plastic shell from inside his pack as a short backboard. He then cut the straps off Amanda's bib ski pants and gently put her already jacketed arms and upper body into his ski coat. Next, he removed her boots and slid her into his ski pants, carefully threading the bib straps underneath her back. The knife came in handy again, as Scott fashioned two primitive booties out of the large zippered compartments of his pack. Hopefully, they would help keep Amanda's feet somewhat dry. Taking her down the mountain with her heavy boots on was not an option. Not only would the added weight be difficult for Scott to bear, but it could also exacerbate any trauma she might have already suffered. He put the nylon booties over her boot liners and pushed her feet gently into them. Knowing he could never clomp all the way back in his own heavy, uncomfortable ski boots, Scott pulled out his liners to keep his feet warm and then used what was left of his pack to fashion his own booties from the waterproof nylon. Feeling like a post-apocalyptic caveman, Scott was now ready to drag Amanda out of their hole and hopefully down to safety. As he readied himself to go, Scott realized he had made a critical mistake. In an effort to protect Amanda from any falling snow or ice, he had dug the entrance to the escape tunnel at her feet. Amanda was wearing his bib pants so that Scott could pull her by the excess length of the straps dangling next to her shoulders, which meant she was pointed in the wrong direction to be dragged from the cave. It was bad enough that Scott was going to drag her anywhere without knowing how injured she was, but now, to get her out, he was going to have to turn her around. The cave was only 3.5 feet wide, so he would also have to bend Amanda's legs to do it. Could this get any worse? Ever so gently, he bent her knees up. Next, he placed his hands beneath her shoulder blades and began maneuvering her upper body toward their only way out. Scott knew all too well that if Amanda had suffered any damage to her back, he could be making it permanent. She was such a good kid with such energy. The thought that she could end up paralyzed because of his effort made him sick, but he knew that he couldn't allow his emotions to control his thinking. It ran counter to his training. He tried to filter the thoughts from his mind, but not before he heard a sickening pop. Harbath froze in his tracks. "Please, God, please tell me that wasn't something in Amanda's back," he said to himself. When he looked down, he saw her ski jacket had caught and chipped off a piece of ice on the cave floor. Scott breathed a sigh of relief, and then another, when he had Amanda fully turned around and at the mouth of the tunnel. It was as if he had to go into a cold, dark womb, turn a breech baby, and now had to pull it through the birth canal into the world. With his ski gloves back on and the loose straps of the bib ski pants in his hands, Scott moved backward 2 feet and then pulled Amanda slowly forward for one. The journey out of the icy cave seemed to take forever. At this point, it was nothing but Scott's sheer force of will that kept them moving. To pull Amanda's limp body through the final vertical portion of the tunnel, Scott had to summon every ounce of strength his reserves had to offer. It didn't matter how tired he was or how much pain he was in. The only thing that mattered, and the only outcome Scott Harbath was willing to accept, was complete and total success in extricating Amanda Rutledge, the president's daughter and one-day-old member of the Sweet 16 Club, from that icy cave and getting her back home to safety. After he slid Amanda onto the snow next to the mouth of the tunnel, he sat for a moment to catch his breath and quiet the symphony of screaming muscles throughout his body. He removed his flashlight and checked Amanda's eyes again. They were still dilated. He took off a glove and checked her pulse. It had grown weaker. He had to get moving, now. Careful not to disturb her neck, Scott unfurled the hood from beneath the collar of his jacket and Velcroed it shut as best he could around Amanda's face. With the wind and snow blowing so hard, he wanted to keep her as warm and dry as possible. He stood, wrapped his hands around the straps of Amanda's makeshift stretcher, and slowly began easing her down the mountain. The going was brutally difficult. Scott continually sank down into snow up to his knees, sometimes even to his thighs. There was no way to tell which snow was firm and which would give way, and every time Scott sank into one of these unexpected patches, the added weight of Amanda's stretcher-borne body dangerously threatened to topple him over and send them both hurtling down the face of the mountain. The wind bit into Scott with a piercing cold, against which neither his exertion nor the tepid fumes from his emptying tank of adrenaline could warm him. The razor-sharp crystals of snow tore in sheets across his exposed face like sandpaper. Harvath fought back against the storm and commanded himself to go forward one step at a time. Hampering his already slow movement was the knowledge that he had to proceed with a gem cutter's precision so as to shield Amanda from any added trauma whatsoever.
"One foot in front of the other," thought Scott. "Failure is not an option. We will make it."
He pressed forward through the hellish wind and cold. He had now lost all sense of time and space. All that mattered was getting Amanda back home. Scott was vaguely aware that his body had stopped shivering in its feeble attempt to keep warm.
"At least my legs are still moving."
But what Scott mistook for his legs moving of his own volition was actually a stumble in slow motion. In truth, his legs had given up 3 yards ago, and it was only through an amazing effort that he kept moving down the mountain without losing complete control. Finally, he fell forward into the snow. Like the old brain teaser about a tree falling in the woods with no one to hear it, Scott wondered, would his fall make any sound, or any difference? After all, they were completely alone. Or, so he thought. 200 yards away, wearing next-generation infrared goggles, the leader of Amanda's Secret Service intercept team picked up the heat signature of two forms prone in the snow. In a breakout maneuver that would have made the best F-18 pilot envious, the agent gunned his Polaris snowmobile in their direction. Within seconds, the snowmobile's miles-per-hour gauge showed the needle well over 100, and he quickly closed the gap with Scott and Amanda. The rest of the intercept team was hot on his trail. The leader pulled up next to Scott and Amanda, while the rest of the team surrounded the two bodies lying in the snow and used their goggles to continue searching the immediate area. As an agent carefully rolled him over, Scott let out a low moan.
"It's Norseman! He's alive!"
shouted the team leader to the other intercept members. He then moved over to Amanda and felt for a pulse. It was weak, but at least her heart was beating.
"He's got Goldilocks, too! They're both alive, but in bad shape."
The team leader engaged his throat mic in an attempt to raise the command center.
"Birdhouse, this is Hermes. Do you read? Over?"
There was no response, which is what he had expected. His original orders had been not to escort anyone back, but the game had changed. Every Secret Service agent was selected on the basis of a wide variety of criteria. One of the most highly prized was intelligence, along with the ability to make the right decisions in a life-or-death situation. Hermes addressed his men.
"I want 2 pop toboggans inflated. I will transport Goldilocks on mine, and Archimedes will transport Norseman. I'm changing our status to medevac under Hostile 2. Hammer 4 and Hammer 5 will take the GPS coordinates so we can return to this location to search for the rest of the party. Let's move. Go! Go!"
Harvath was only faintly aware of the hissing air and of being strapped into the emergency inflatable pop-up toboggan. As soon as the intercept team swung the snowmobiles around to speed them all back to the command center, he once again slipped into unconsciousness. 13. By the time the Lions reached the farmhouse of Joseph and Mary Maddox, they were 7 minutes ahead of schedule. Miner was pleased. The farmhouse had been selected because of its remote location. It was on the outskirts of the small town of Midway, which bordered Deer Valley. The nearest neighbor was 3 miles away. The only access was via either a terribly potholed dirt road or the narrow canyon behind the west side of the farm, which, during this time of year, was only navigable by experienced snowmobile operators or cross-country skiers. Joe and Mary Maddox had spent their Sunday the same way as always. Even though their large, extended Mormon family saw them as retired, the word didn't exist in their vocabulary. And who could be, with 22 grandchildren and 11 great-grandchildren? If anything, the Maddoxes had become even busier in their golden years. The morning had started with the elderly couple getting up before the sun. While their faith prohibited labor on the Sabbath, there were some exceptions, such as tending to animals, which Joe and Mary did before having breakfast, and heading off to their ward for Sunday services. The bishop spoke of the success of 4 local Mormon boys on a mission in Asia, and the tragedy of 2 others who had been killed in the past week in an Atlanta ghetto while they were spreading the good news of the Mormon church. Joe's mind wandered, as it did more and more these days during the almost 5-hour Sunday services. Mary, ever the devout follower, listened intently as the bishop spoke about the role of a good Mormon wife and reminded his flock that it was only through a husband's proclamation that a wife would be accepted into the celestial kingdom. Mary smiled at Joe, knowing that after 57 years of marriage to her best friend, he was certainly going to bring her into the celestial kingdom with him. She was absolutely correct. What she didn't know was how soon she would be dispatched. For the last week, Joe had been feeling a bit under the weather, and so he and Mary decided to forego the traditional Sunday family supper at their oldest daughter's home. Instead, they decided they would have a light meal and relax at the farmhouse, without the distraction of children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Had they chosen to attend supper at their daughter's house, it would have saved their lives. At 2 in the afternoon, no one really paid attention to the 18-wheeler truck that rolled down Sweetwater Road toward the Maddox farmhouse. Its driver cursed the minefield of potholes he was forced to navigate. The truck was emblazoned with the Mormon Church's trademark seagulls and the logo of Deseret Industries, so it would appear as if it were headed out to a farm to pick up a charitable donation of furniture, farm supplies, or canned goods, or to deliver a contribution to a deserving family. Although the church never did anything on Sundays, Miner had anticipated correctly that anyone who saw the truck would just assume the church's business was a rare exception to Sabbath abstinence. Miner's groundsman turned up the long snow-covered lane of the Maddox farm, convinced that he had not drawn any undue attention to himself. The idea of painting the semi-truck and trailer with the Mormon Seagulls and Deseret Industries logo had been brilliant. In a state where Mormons were raised not to question the actions of their church, and where non-Mormons didn't pay much attention to Mormon goings-on, nothing would seem out of place, and therefore the truck was the perfect cover. Miner had also informed the groundsman that to the trained eye of someone like a state trooper, the truck would obviously appear overloaded. But even troopers wouldn't pull it over, for fear of the tangled web of hassles it might create in this heavily Mormon state. The lane opened into a wide courtyard, which was bordered by the farmhouse, a large white barn, 2 grain silos, and several outbuildings. The groundsman turned the truck around so that it was facing the way it came, with the trailer doors pointed toward the barn. It was parked at a slight angle so that any passing motorists who might be curious would see that the truck was from the church. Having observed the Maddoxes for the last several weeks, the groundsmen had their routine down pat and knew they would not be home from their daughters before 6:30 at the earliest, and by then the lions would be long gone. He unlocked the rear trailer doors and extended a long skid plate ramp. He then slid open the barn door and disappeared into the semi-trailer. As he was about to unload the first of his cargo, he stopped and cocked his head in the direction of the driveway, thinking he heard something. The man's keen hearing hadn't deceived him. Faintly, in the distance, was the low rumble of Joe Maddox's truck turning up the snow-covered driveway. Quickly, the groundsman jumped out of the back of the trailer, closed its metal doors, and slid the ramp back into place. A million questions should have raced through his mind, but he was trained to react, not waste time. He managed to slide the huge barn door closed before Maddox's truck came into full view. In his blue and white Deseret Industries coveralls, he knew he looked the part. He struck a casual pose by the side of the semi and even managed a small grin. He waved to Joe and Mary Maddox as they pulled into the courtyard. "Good afternoon, Elder Maddox," said the groundsman with a slight Utah lax on the consonants of his perfect American English, when Joe Maddox stepped down from his pickup truck. "And good afternoon to you as well, sister."
"Good afternoon," replied the couple in unison.
Mary climbed out of the passenger side to get a better look at the enormous truck parked in their driveway.
"I'm sorry I'm a little late for our appointment," said the groundsman, as he walked toward the couple, his right hand outstretched.
"Our appointment," replied a confused Joe Maddox, who shook the groundsman's hand and then watched Mary do the same.
"Yeah, I got caught up in traffic on 215, and then with this weather and all, I almost couldn't get up the canyon. But being a soldier for the Lord, doing the church's good work, I think he was looking out for me."
The logos on the truck and the uniform of the groundsman impressed Joe Maddox. Ever mindful of pleasing the church, he replied, "I owe you an apology. I didn't know we had an appointment. I feel a bit embarrassed. Can you tell me what this is all about?"
"Oh, no, don't tell me. You folks didn't hear about this either? Well, if this isn't the third surprise stop I've made today, and on a Sunday to boot, I'm going to have to get on the phone and give someone a good talking to," said the groundsman, smiling.
This time it was Mrs. Maddox who spoke.
"We don't know what this is all about, but if it involves the church, I'm sure they do. It's cold out here. Why don't we go inside and you can use our phone to get to the bottom of this?"
"You are both too kind."
The Maddoxes led the groundsman across the snowy drive and toward the farmhouse. They climbed the flight of concrete stairs, and Mr. Maddox opened the glass storm door, covered with the sun-faded stickers of his grandchildren. Joe then opened the unlocked front door, seemingly unconcerned that he was revealing his lack of security. It didn't matter. The groundsman already knew that the Maddoxes habitually left their home unlocked. As a matter of fact, he'd been inside on several different occasions, both when they were out and when they were home asleep. He probably knew the house and the property better than the doddering old couple did themselves.
"So how can we help, Mr.?" began Joe Maddox.
"Baker, Brian Baker, sir," replied the groundsman. "I'm here to pick up some old farm equipment that you offered to donate for some of the church projects in Mexico."
"Hmm," said Maddox, as his wife took his coat and hung it in the hall closet. "I can't say that I remember offering to donate any farm equipment. I mean, we have in the past, but now all we really have is the tractor for the light bit of cropping we do, and we need that. I don't know what to tell you. Must have been some sort of mistake somewhere."
"There probably was. Like I said, you folks aren't the first ones today who were an incorrect pickup for me. Would you mind if I make a quick call to the dispatch at Deseret to let them know?"
"Of course you can," replied Mrs. Maddox. "You can use the phone in the kitchen. Just follow me."
"Thank you, ma'am."
"Not at all."
Mrs. Maddox led the groundsman to a canary yellow rotary dial phone that looked as if it had been mounted on the wall in the mid-70s.
"I haven't seen one of these in years," marveled the groundsman. "I didn't even know folks still used rotary phones."
He laughed. Mrs. Maddox smiled.
"We have a simple rule around here. If it ain't broke, don't fix it."
"I hear you. Too many folks spending too much money on things they just don't need."
"Amen to that," came the voice of Mr. Maddox from the other room, where he had turned on the old color television set.
"Ma'am, I don't want to be a bother, but we've got one of those tricky phone mail systems down at the dispatch."
"Oh, I can't stand those," broke in Mrs. Maddox.
"Well, that makes two of us," responded the groundsman with his warmest smile. "But you see, I need to use a push-button phone if I want to bypass the system and get through to the dispatch man.
Seeing how it's Sunday, all we've got is a skeleton crew down in Salt Lake. There's no operator on duty. You wouldn't happen to have a push-button phone, would you?
The groundsman knew perfectly well that they did, and where it was located.
Yes, we do have one upstairs, but I think our service is just rotary. Would that still cause a problem for you?
No, ma'am, lied the groundsman.
Okay, then. Follow me and I'll show you where it is.
Halfway up, he stopped and asked Mrs. Maddox,
Ma'am, do you suppose your husband would mind coming up, just in case I need him to confirm anything to the dispatcher?
Of course not, said Mary Maddox,
who leaned over the banister and called to her husband.
Okay, I'm coming,
yelled back Mr. Maddox, who didn't like being pulled away from his TV, even if it was for the church. Mary led the groundsman into the master bedroom. On the nightstand was a touch-tone phone with oversized glow-in-the-dark buttons. It was pre-programmed with the names of the Maddox's children and had special speed dial buttons for police, fire, and ambulance. The groundsman moved toward the right side of the bed, next to the phone, and unzipped the top of his coveralls. He pretended to fumble in his breast pocket for something.
I've got that invoice in here somewhere. Probably ought to get a clipboard one of these days.
Mrs. Maddox smiled politely and inwardly hoped that this misunderstanding would not put her and Joe in bad standing with the church. The groundsman heard the footsteps of Mr. Maddox as he came down the green shag carpeted hallway. He stopped fumbling in his coveralls when he found the true item he was looking for. His hand tightened around the butt of a cold Walther P-4. The 9mm was fitted with a silencer, and despite its extended length, he drew it from his coveralls in less than the blink of an eye. This was the part that he enjoyed the most, the expressions on his victims' faces when they knew death was only seconds away. But this couple had no telling expressions whatsoever. They were in utter shock, and their faces were blank. This kind of thing never happened in Midway, never even happened in Utah. It was utterly beyond their ability to comprehend. Not even a sniffle from the missus. They just stood there as if they were watching it happen to someone else on television. Then the dam broke. Mrs. Maddox let out a wail. The tears welled up in her eyes and began to roll down her cheeks as the reality of the situation hit her full force. They were going to die. The mister, on the other hand, still had no clue. His instinct was to comfort his wife, and as he reached out for her, the groundsman shot him twice in the forehead. Spatters of blood mingled with slivers of bone and pulpy gray matter sprayed across Mary's face as she began a repetitive mumble through her sobbing. All she could manage was,
Oh God, oh God, oh God.
Good thing you went to church this morning, eh, Mary?
Hissed the groundsman, his English now accented with his Swiss-German tongue.
In your next life, when the kids invite you to dinner, I suggest you accept.
He pointed the suppressed Walther at Mary Maddox and pulled the trigger. Anticipating the end, Mary turned her head at the last moment. The bullet tore away a huge piece of flesh and the underlying cartilage from the bridge of her nose. She fell to the floor screaming. Angrily, the groundsman fired his remaining rounds into her neck, chest, face, and head as she writhed in agony on the bedroom floor. Soon, her movement ceased, and she was still. Mr. Maddox, unlike his wife, the groundsman mused, had been cooperative enough to fall back onto the bed. The groundsman lifted the man's feet and placed them on top of the chenille bedspread. Except for the bullet holes in his head, it looked as if he had just lain down to take a nap. The groundsman then dragged Mrs. Maddox across the floor to the other side of the bed and hefted her up and onto it. When she landed, her arms were upright above her head. He toyed with the idea of stripping the old couple and leaving them in a sexually suggestive pose, wondering what the Mormon relatives would think, but there was other work to be done. After he washed his hands in the small guest bathroom down the hall, careful not to leave any fingerprints, he went outside to finish unloading the contents of the semi into the barn. With the truck unloaded, there was nothing for him to do but come inside and wait for Miner and his fellow lions. The small family room was warm, and its large window provided the groundsman as good a view as possible through the blowing snow of anyone coming up the driveway. The television was still on, tuned to a station with an American football game. Halfway through the third quarter, and a pack of cigarettes later, the groundsman began to feel the telltale signs of his low blood sugar level. Healthy as a horse since a child, he had made his doctor in Zurich explain 3 times how diabetes could have chosen him when no one in his family had ever had it. The doctor explained that there was no specific reason, but that it was quite manageable, provided he took the right precautions. Of course, the first precaution he took was never to let Miner know about his condition. From a pocket in his coveralls, he withdrew a Nestle's chocolate bar and broke it into perfect little squares, calculating how many he might need to keep his blood sugar up for the rest of the day. He laid the silver foil with its purple and white wrapper on his lap and put a piece of the creamy milk chocolate into his mouth. He sucked on it slowly, savoring it as he closed his eyes. Then, from out of nowhere, came the sound of breaking glass from upstairs. The groundsman leapt from his chair and grabbed the German-made pistol from the end table beside him. Cautiously, he moved forward toward the stairs, crept up them, and then down the hallway's green shag carpet. He inched toward the master bedroom, which was where he believed the sound had come from. He gripped the pistol tighter, grateful that he had replaced its spent magazine. As he neared the bedroom door, he inhaled deeply, applied slight pressure to the trigger, and spun into the open doorframe. In an instant, he had not only surveyed the room, but also the condition of the 2 bodies lying atop the bed. The source of the noise was apparent at once. He had left the woman's arms above her head, and now noticed that one arm was splayed across the nightstand, and the glass frame of a picture of 7 small children lay broken on the floor. Post-mortem reflex. The groundsman lowered his pistol and laughed out loud. As quickly as he started, he stopped. His ears had picked up the high-pitched whine of snowmobiles. He looked at his watch. Miner and the men were ahead of schedule. He took the stairs 3 at a time and landed with a large thud in the downstairs hallway. As he bounded into the family room, he found his chocolate wrapper and bent down to gather up the pieces that had fallen on the floor. Not wanting Miner to find him away from his assigned post, the groundsman folded the wrapper around the chocolate and shoved it back into his coverall pocket. He used his handkerchief to grasp the half-filled water glass he'd been using to ash his cigarettes in and flushed the contents down the hall toilet. He rinsed the glass with rusty brown water from the kitchen tap and returned it to a drying rack next to the sink. He made it outside just in time to pick out the first glimmer of snowmobile headlights. Through the swirling and blowing snow, he could see them speeding toward him at the rear of the farmhouse. 14. With Sam Harper, the Secret Service's #1 man on site, missing in action, Tom Hollenbeck was now in charge. When word reached him that Agent Harvath and the president's daughter had been recovered and brought in unconscious, he left instructions that he was to be notified immediately when either one came to. The storm was making it impossible to coordinate search and rescue efforts. Even so, Hollenbeck contacted Hill Air Force Base's commanding officer and requested that they locate the 2 closest choppers with advanced heat-seeking FLIR, or forward-looking infrared, units and have them flown to Deer Valley as soon as humanly possible. Hollenbeck hoped that by the time they got there, there would be no need for them. But contingency plans always had to be made. All the officers the Secret Service had available were sent out to try and locate the president and his team. As Longo was still having no luck getting the service's Motorola radios to work, Palmer had taken it upon herself to get hold of Deer Valley's resort manager and have him send over as many portable CB radios as he could scrounge. Communications wouldn't be secure, but at this point, that was the least of the Secret Service's worries. Every available ski patroller and search and rescue volunteer from the surrounding 3 counties had been called in to help with the search. At risk were not only the president and the protective details, but the countless number of civilians who'd been skiing on the runs affected by the avalanche. Hollenbeck sent Palmer out with a civilian team to comb the area where Agent Harvath and Amanda had been found.
The remaining Secret Service agents took two of the best search and rescue people from Deer Valley's team and as many local law enforcement personnel as they could muster to help coordinate their search for the president. As much as he hated it, Hollenbeck knew that his job was to stay behind and run the operation from the command center. When the call came that Agent Harvath was regaining consciousness, Hollenbeck grabbed a microcassette recorder and his parka and flew out the door. The soft orange glow of a bedside lamp was the first thing Scott noticed as he began to come to. As his eyes opened further, he saw the boards of knotty pine that paneled the ceiling, and below that, a wallpaper border that ran the length of the room and depicted moose and deer in a wooded area. The blanket on top of him was heavy. It felt as if he had on more than one, but the one he could see was red and gray wool with white snowflakes. As Scott looked further down toward his feet, he noticed the footboard was carved from rough-hewn logs. He then realized he was in one of the guest rooms of the president's chalet, and it was still night.
"Well, it looks like the wee lad is finally waking up," came a voice with a mock Scottish accent.
Scott's reflexes kicked in, and he tried to sit up.
"Amanda, where's..."
"Whoa," came the voice again. This time the funny accent was gone, and the man spoke in his normal Texas drawl. "She's here, Scott, just across the hall. Dr. Paulus is taking care of her."
"How is she?"
"To tell you the truth, I don't know. My main concern is you right now, so let's relax and let me take a look." The doctor removed a penlight from the bag next to him and shined it in both of Scott's eyes.
"I want to see her."
"First, I'm going to complete my exam, then we're going to get an update from Dr. Paulus, and then if he says it's okay, you can see her." The voice, bad accent and all, belonged to Dr. Skip Trawick. He and John Paulus had been friends of Scott since his ski team days. Scott was a pretty good mimic, but the Scottish accent was one he just couldn't get down, so Skip always used it as his funny way of saying hello. As head of the advance team for the trip to Park City, Scott had recommended both Skip and Dr. Paulus as the on-site medical pros. Now he wondered if that had been such a good idea.
"Damn it, Skip. Who the hell do you think got you and John these gigs as docs for the presidential party? Let me up. I have to see her."
"You, my friend, haven't changed a bit, you know that? Still as haggis-headed as ever."
"Cut the crap."
"It would be my pleasure. But first, the exam. Now, how many fingers do you see?"
"None. You haven't poured anything yet."
"So far, I'm going to say your neurological function is the same as it always was, low to subpar."
"Yuck, yuck, yuck. Come on, Skip. I want to peek in on her. I have to know how she is."
"As soon as I'm finished. Any areas of severe pain?"
"Yeah, right on my ass. I'm going to give you the count of three to help me out of this bed, or I'm going to shove you off and do it myself. One."
"Alive and kicking. That's a good sign, isn't it, Dr. Trawick?" asked Tom Hollenbeck as he threw his parka on a chair next to the door and made his way over to the bed. "Maybe. The patient, though, claims to have a pain in the ass," replied Dr. Trawick. "The patient is a pain in the ass," said Hollenbeck. "What's the story? Anything broken? Concussion?"
"I haven't been able to complete my examination as of yet. The patient is not being compliant."
"Not compliant? Skip, you son of a... I'll give you non-compliant."
"And a wee bit aggressive," said Skip, the Scottish accent back again.
"Jesus, Skip, you're on duty. Could you at least pretend to be a professional for a few minutes?" On second thought, "Fuck this. I'm getting up," said Scott.
"Hold on there, Harvath," Hollenbeck said sternly. "I want you to cooperate. None of this tough guy stuff. You just lie there and let the doc take a look at you."
"Fine. Go ahead, Skip. The sooner you're finished, the sooner I can get over to Amanda."
"You're not going anywhere until I get a full statement from you. Just settle down, would you?" "My God, Scott. We've got a very serious situation on our hands right now, so get focused," said Hollenbeck.
"I'm sorry, Tom. You're right. If the good doctor would unplug me from this IV, I'd be happy to get started."
"No way, Jose. The IV stays in. You came in severely dehydrated. I want to get some more fluids into you first," said Dr. Trawick, as he continued to examine Scott from head to toe. "I brought a tape recorder with me.
We'll take your statement verbally, said Hollenbeck.
Verbally? But what about him?
Said Scott, as he motioned to Dr. Trawick.
What about me? I'm still on non-operational special forces duty, Scott.
Oh, so that's what you call shagging kegs when members of your old unit come to town? Said Harvath.
Listen, as one of the quiet professionals, I know how to keep my mouth shut.
Oh, yeah? Could have fooled me, because it's always open.
Hollenbeck hated to break up the love fest, but he had bigger concerns. Dr. Trawick, I don't have time for you to sign a national security non-disclosure document. I am aware of your status as a special forces operative, and I know that you've maintained your top secret clearance. In the interest of tending to your patient and the ongoing emergency, I want to make sure you understand that nothing said within this room is to be repeated.
No problem, Agent Hollenbeck. You have my word.
Can you also get his word that he'll shut up and not repeat that lame-ass story of how he served his country by treating an elephant in the Kuwaiti Zoo during Desert Storm?
Well, now who's the comedian? Why don't you try to sit up? I want to listen to your heart and check your ribs.
Harvath stifled a groan as Dr. Trawick helped him sit up. The agents who brought him in had cut away his sweater and turtleneck, as well as his lycra pants, placing him in a hospital-style gown before putting him into bed. As Harvath leaned forward, his gown was open in back, and Hollenbeck saw what looked like a topographical map of green, blue, and yellow islands, bruises that covered his back and shoulders.
Holy shit. Are you sure you're up to this? Asked Hollenbeck.
Trawick said, I'm going to shoot some adrenaline into your IV, and that should help give you a little more strength. You want anything for the pain?
No, let's get this over with. And then I want you to clear me for the hot tub downstairs so I can soak this out.
Scott, this isn't some post-ski competition session. You walloped yourself quite a few times back in those days, and God knows you scared the bejesus out of me more than once. But your body has suffered some serious trauma here. So far, it doesn't look like anything's broken. If there's no blood in your urine, I might postpone having you go to the hospital for further tests. But if I do, you're going to stay right here in this bed for several days at least. Now shut up for a second and take a deep breath.
Scott did as he was told, and Hollenbeck waited until the doctor had removed the stethoscope from his ears before he launched into a series of questions and recorded everything on tape for later transcription. Scott ran down the list, seeing the president, Harper, and the rest of the team at the last lap, Amanda's wipeout, and the communications outage, the decision to take her through the bowl to get back to the house, the avalanche, getting to the outcropping, being buried, digging out, and trying to get Amanda's unconscious body back to the house. Occasionally, Dr. Trawick broke in with questions that pushed Scott to reach a little further back. Long-term memory questions like, what's your address, your telephone, and driver's license numbers were easy for him to answer, but he had problems with some short-term memory questions, such as, what hotel are you staying in, what airline did you fly to Utah on, and when was your last visit to the White House? When he was finished recounting his tale, the room was completely silent. After a moment, Dr. Trawick let out a long whistle.
You know how lucky you are to be alive, boy? He asked.
Yeah, I know.
I worry, though, about the short-term memory loss. I don't know how much is gone.
Like you said, Skip, it's just like the old days. I got whacked in the head, and I'm a little fuzzy on some utterly unimportant stuff, I might add, but it'll come back.
I'm sure it will, but at some point, I'm going to need to run some tests on you nonetheless.
Scott ignored Skip and turned to Hollenbeck and asked,
What's the status on the others? The President, Harp, Maxwell.
Hollenbeck inhaled deeply before he responded. At this point, there is no status. The radios are still down, and you and Amanda are the only ones we have recovered. Scott couldn't believe his ears.
No status? That's ridiculous. Nothing from the CAT or JAR teams? Nothing off the smocks? You can't even get his 5 cents worth?
5 cents worth referred to the homing device that every president was provided with by the Secret Service. It was an Indian head nickel containing a transmitter that operated on a special frequency that could deliver GPS coordinates.
The president always carried this coin on his person and referred to it as his good luck piece, although tonight it didn't seem to be bringing anyone any good luck. The Motorolas, the Smocks, everything was intermittent throughout the day. Because it was across the entire communications platform, we wrote it off to weather or mountain shadow anomalies. It wasn't until we were down for several minutes that we raised the alarm. So, in answer to your question, we have no status.
What about search and rescue?
All available agents have been sent to Death Chute, with some of the Ski Patrol and Sheriff's Department S&R guys. Agent Palmer is leading a civilian team back where we picked you and Goldilocks up. I think Palmer's team is going to have better luck.
Why do you say that?
You were picked up in the bowl. The bowl is easily accessible. We've already got some construction lamps and related equipment en route. I must have personally spoken with every construction company within a 100-mile radius. Any and all heavy earth-moving equipment that exists is trying to make its way there right now.
But what about the president and Sam?
You tell me, Scott. You've skied Death Chute. You were the one who was in charge of securing it. What kind of equipment do you think we could get onto a nearly vertical drop face?
Choppers.
Grounded.
Not our stuff. Not those Marine pilots.
Yes, even our stuff, and even our guys. When you feel up to it, take a peek out the window. You can't even see your hand in front of your face. It's a complete whiteout. What's more, we can't get lights up where we need them, and we certainly can't get any cranes or bulldozers in there because the area is so inaccessible. As the severity of the situation began to sink in, Harvath pressed his palms against his forehead. What we do have going for us, Hollenbeck continued, is that you saw the president's detail make it to the first plateau around the treed area. The CAT team waiting at the bottom never saw them come out, so we have a general idea of where they might be.
But that snow came roaring down the mountain. They could have been totally swept past the CAT team.
I don't think so. If you really did see Ahern and Houchins wipe out by the trees, then the rest of the detail would have held up for them. I'm going to assume that they heard and interpreted the avalanche the same way you did and went into the trees. We've got over 50 people up there right now with dogs. We have to hope for the best. The mushers will work the pups and the rest will link and sink. Link and sink was a search and rescue technique in which a line of people moved forward side by side as if linked by an invisible chain, sinking long aluminum poles into the snow every foot, in an effort to feel something or someone underneath. Scott looked up at Hollenbeck.
Have you called Washington yet?
Yeah. They told me we're authorized for anything we need. Dr. Trawick cleared his throat, indicating that he was through with his examination. Scott and Agent Hollenbeck both turned to look at him. There's no question that you took quite a beating. I'm still amazed that, all things considered, you didn't break anything. In light of what happened, your injuries are relatively minor.
Good, then I can...
Hold on a second. I'm not finished. When I say your injuries are minor, that doesn't mean they aren't serious. While nothing appears to be broken, you may have a few cracked ribs. I want to wrap you with an ace, ice the bruised areas, and then get you into my office for some x-rays and probably a CT scan. Until then, you are to stay in bed. I'm going to keep you on the IV for another 12 hours and monitor you. What I am most concerned about is your head trauma. So, for the time being, you are staying put.
Thanks all the same, Doc, but I plan on going back out there to help in the search. They need every live body they can get.
You're welcome all the same, but you're not going anywhere. Your body is of no use to anyone in this condition. You go out there like this, and they'll end up having to waste time carrying you right back in again.
I doubt that.
And, beyond the total fatigue and exhaustion you have suffered, there's also some frostbite and mild hypothermia. Any average person probably would have died out there. Your survival says a lot about your training and will to live. I repeat, you are one lucky SOB.
Are you finished now? Because I've got stuff I've got to do, said Scott, as he tried to raise himself off the bed.
Lie down, barked Hollenbeck. That's an order. Harvath, why do you insist on being such a jackass sometimes?
Tom, with all due respect, I was head of the advance team,
The safety of the presidential party as well as my fellow agents was and is my responsibility. You need my help.
Not in this condition, I don't. Forget it.
I'm not going to debate this with you, Tom.
You're damn right you're not. You're staying in that bed until Dr. Trawick and Dr. Paulus say otherwise. You got me?
Come on, Tom. Be realistic.
A crackle, followed by Hollenbeck's call sign over the CB radio clipped to his belt, prevented him from arguing any further with Scott, and he raised his hand for silence.
This is Birdhouse. Over.
Birdhouse, this is Hermes. We've got something. Over.
Copy, Hermes. What's the situation? Over.
Despite the effort, Scott sat straight up to listen to the exchange.
Birdhouse, it appears as if we have recovered two agents from Hattrick's detail. They're extricating them as we speak.
Thank God, Hollenbeck thought to himself.
What's their condition? Over.
Still extracting.
Hold on a sec. I'm moving over to get a better view.
Roger that. Birdhouse is holding.
Several seconds passed.
Birdhouse! Birdhouse! Hattrick's agents are down. Unnatural causes. I repeat, unnatural causes.
Hollenbeck couldn't believe what he was hearing. Scott strained forward to take in every piece of information. He knew that there was absolute pandemonium on the face of Death Chute right now. All of the agents would have their guns drawn, feeling vulnerable in the dark, not knowing if the threat was still present or long since gone.
Hermes, this is Birdhouse. Tell your team to sweep and reap. I repeat, your team is to sweep and reap. Do you copy? Over.
Sweep and reap was the command to scour the immediate area for hostile targets. If any were encountered, the threat was to be neutralized by taking the perpetrators into custody or by punching their tickets as quickly as possible.
Roger, Birdhouse. Hermes' team will sweep and reap. Over.
Hollenbeck had four CAT teams outside, and he got on the radio and mobilized them next. Two headed off toward Death Chute, and the other two took defensive positions around the house. As he completed his commands, he turned back to see Scott trying to get out of bed. This was more than he needed to handle. He turned to Dr. Trawick.
Sedate him. Now.
We can't do that, not in his condition.
Fine. I want a guard on this door tonight. He doesn't leave.
Harvath was only able to squeeze out a couple of words of protest before Hollenbeck grabbed his parka and ran out of the room, slamming the door behind him. Scott knew he was licked, at least for now.
15. Miner once again looked at his watch. Everything was still going according to schedule. Every phase of the operation brought with it new challenges and potential pitfalls. The greatest risk Miner and his team were running right now was in transporting their precious cargo, but even in that, he had plotted for every eventuality. Wasatch Front Ambulance Squad Service had a fleet of 15 vehicles that, in one of the fastest-growing counties in America, were always in demand. Drivers performed routine inspections of their rigs, as they called them, before each shift. With them driving so many steeply graded mountain passes every week, their brakes were of the utmost importance to them. When the driver of Ambulance 17 had come on duty yesterday and found brake fluid pooled on the ground beneath his rig, he immediately notified the dispatcher. As Wasatch's mechanic was overwhelmed with a string of mysterious problems on four other rigs, the dispatcher called to have the rig towed to a local garage where it could be repaired by an outside mechanic. When the tow truck arrived and picked up Ambulance 17, the groundsman had been waiting across the street in a nondescript gold Ford Taurus to take down the name, address, and telephone number of the mechanic shop stenciled in bright green letters on the side of the tow truck. A simple call from his cell phone to Grunna Automotive verified what Miner had told him to expect in the land of Utah. After closing early on Saturday, the garage would not open again until Monday. The alarm system at Grunna Automotive was more for show than anything else. The groundsman had it deactivated in no time. He spent the next half hour repairing the ambulance and helping himself to Cokes from the refrigerator in Mr. Grunna's office. He then slipped into dark blue trousers and a dark blue shirt with official-looking patches on it,
drove the ambulance out of the garage, being careful to close the roll-down door behind him, and rendezvoused with the Deseret Industries 18-wheeler, into which he loaded the ambulance. 18 hours later, as the stolen ambulance rocketed down Provo Canyon, passing the Sundance Resort, Miner phoned the pilot of his chartered MetaJet plane. He spoke with the urgency of a doctor transporting a patient in very serious condition. The wail of the sirens and the clipped British accent he affected dovetailed perfectly with what the MetaJet crew had been led to believe was their assignment. The refinery fire in Magna, Utah, 2 weeks prior, had been one of the worst the industry had ever seen. The blaze had burned uncontrollably for several days, and the smoke had been so thick that it had shut down all but 2 runways at Salt Lake City International Airport. Before the flames had been extinguished, environmentalists from several groups had flocked to the scene with their banners, decrying the continued pollution of the environment by big business, particularly the oil and gas industries. Several media outlets had run stories about the mounting toll oil and gas disasters were taking on the planet. On television, scenes of the Kuwaiti oil fields aflame during the Gulf War competed for time alongside images of dead oil-soaked seabirds being plucked from the shores of Alaska following the Exxon Valdez disaster. The Magna refinery fire was worldwide news.
"And will we be able to take off?" Miner asked into his cell phone from inside the bumpy ambulance.
"Yes, sir, doctor. As far as we can tell from the weather reports and our information from the tower, this window should hold for about 45 more minutes."
"Good. And you have informed the tower of our need for priority slotting for takeoff?"
"Yes, sir. From the looks of it now, we're the only ones that'll be leaving, but as a medical emergency, we have priority anyway."
"Good. How is the air traffic in general throughout the area?"
"This is typical mountain weather. The snow and wind have tapered off some down here in the valley, but it's pounding the higher elevations up in the mountains. Salt Lake International is experiencing stack-ups both in and out. Even with a medical emergency, we still would have had our work cut out for us getting off the ground out of SLC. Miner had arranged for the MetaJet to await his team at the Provo Municipal Airport in Orem, 40 miles south of Salt Lake City, for precisely these very reasons. First, he could count on the weather being less severe at the lower elevation airport than at the one up by Deer Valley. And second, with a medical emergency out of Provo Municipal, Miner knew that he would call all of the shots. The runway would be plowed and the jet de-iced by the time he got there. All he needed to do was load his patient and they would immediately be cleared for takeoff. The fact that the private airfield would ask few questions and their security was lax to non-existent had been another plus. The pilot spoke again over Miner's cell phone.
"What is the patient's condition?"
"He's stable, but still critical."
"Confirmed. Per your instructions, doctor, we have added the extra equipment you asked for."
"Excellent. And you are sure that there will be no problem with the stretcher and its oxygen tent fitting in the plane?"
"Absolutely not. Normally, we would transfer the patient from the ambulance stretcher to our own, but when you explained that the tent seal couldn't be breached because of the risk of infection, we just offloaded our stretcher. As long as yours has the dimensions you indicated, our clamps will be able to secure it in place. I just hope he'll be comfortable. It's quite a long flight to Stansted."
"I appreciate your concern. He's pretty heavily sedated, as you can imagine."
"I would imagine. It is such a tragedy. I think everyone was moved by the Magna fire."
"Indeed, this gentleman is lucky to be alive, but we're just not sure for how much longer. Have you made the arrangements for us with British Customs?"
"Yes, just as you asked. I have alerted our London office, and they have been in contact with the authorities at Stansted Airport. If you provide me with all of your passports on the plane, including the patients, we'll have you cleared before you have him in your transport."
"And your office is aware of the severity of this man's injuries? Third-degree burns over 95% of his body, including his face."
"Yes, doctor. The authorities will also be made aware of that fact, as well as the issue of the tent not being breached. To tell you the truth, I don't think you're going to run into any problems at all. Like I said, there doesn't seem to be anyone who wasn't touched by this story. Plus, the patient is British, correct?"
"Yes, he is."
"Well, I found that always helps. I mean, here is this poor... what was his occupation?"
"A chemist for Fawcett Petroleum."
Right, a chemist. Here this poor chemist is burned in a terrible fire, and all he wants to do is be repatriated so he can die on his own soil surrounded by his family. If there is even the slightest hiccup with the immigration folks at Stansted, they're going to have to deal with me personally.
Thank you, Captain. I am counting on that. Our ETA is 15 minutes. Please contact the tower for your clearance and have the jet ready for takeoff.
Roger. As Miner pushed the end button on his cell phone, he turned to the groundsman working next to him.
How are we doing?
The groundsman, not only a master assassin, but also a master of disguise, sat back and invited Miner to admire his handiwork.
Excellent, commented Miner, as they sealed the oxygen tent above the stretcher.
Through an ingenious use of latex and special effects makeup, the President of the United States had been hideously transformed. One look at him, along with a mention of the Magna refinery fire, would be all they needed to turn even the most difficult and hard-hearted customs official to jelly. The unbreachable oxygen tent, complete with a patient who in no way could match his photo in the false passport Miner carried for him, would get them waved right through the security of Stansted Airport. Of that, Miner was sure. The officials might even offer him a motorcade, which, of course, he would be forced to decline. 16. When Harvath awoke, he had no idea how long he'd been sleeping. His eyes focused, and he saw he was in the same room he had been brought to last night. At least, he hoped it had been last night. It must have been. There was no way he could have been out for more than 6 hours, 8 tops. Even though the curtains were drawn, he could tell that it was early morning. The snow was still falling, but not as hard as before. He decided from the pressure on his bladder that he had gotten more than enough fluids, and so he reached over and pulled the IV from his arm. Across the room to his left was the open door to a bathroom. Dr. Skip would be pissed, no pun intended, that he hadn't saved his urine for him to examine, but that was life. Scott's stomach muscles contracted as he crunched painfully upward and used his arms as buttresses to keep himself from falling backward onto his pillow. The pain not only was still in his back and shoulders, but had found new places to set up shop.
Halfway there,
Scott thought to himself. He shifted his weight onto his left arm, and with his right, reached out and threw back the covers. Breathing a little harder than just getting out of bed warranted, he inhaled deeply, and in one motion, swung his feet out from under the blankets, pivoting his body so that he now sat on the edge of the bed. With the weight off his arms, he was now able to stretch. His range of motion was severely limited. He had taken some beatings before, but this one was definitely Academy Award material. Nothing, though, that a long, hot shower couldn't help. Harvath eased his feet to the floor and slowly stood up from the bed. His legs were weak, but with a concerted effort, he propelled himself forward to the bathroom. Taking the gown off was the hard part. With the straps tied behind him and his arms so stiff, he couldn't reach around to untie them. He walked toward the toilet, lifted the bottom half of the gown like a skirt, and began to relieve himself. Then, ever so slowly, Scott inched the gown over his head until it came all the way off. He reached inside the shower and turned the control all the way to hot. As he did, he caught a glimpse of his back in the mirror. He wouldn't win any beauty pageants, that was for sure, but it would heal.
God bless the president for having friends that can afford houses like this,
Scott thought, as he sat on the marble bench in the ornate shower and let the hot water beat down on him. After what he figured had been a good 15 minutes, he flipped the lever that activated the steam shower and closed his eyes. As he breathed in the searing moisture, he replayed the events of the past 24 hours in his mind. The avalanche didn't make any sense. There had been a lot of snow falling, but both the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center and Deer Valley's avalanche control team had assured him that the risks were minimal. Scott himself had even made the trip up to Squaw Peak to test the conditions that very morning. Could more snow have fallen than he thought? Even though the UAFC had rated the risks minimal, there still had been risks. The weight of responsibility rested heavily upon Scott's battered shoulders. He sat in the shower in a trance and replayed everything over and over in his mind. Then, with a jolt, he sat upright. He had completely forgotten about Hollenbeck's conversation with Hermes right before his exhaustion overtook him.
Two agents down. Unnatural causes.